Janaki Shokanasana Kapitsa Makshanta Vandelankam Payankaram Manojam Marutta Tulya Vegam Chitendriham Udhimatam Vardishtam Vatatmajam.
You are listening to CFRO Community Radio Station. The upcoming show, Conscious Living Radio, is a program that explores frontiers of consciousness, spirituality, personal growth, emerging paradigms in psychology, health, science, and innovative philosophies that reflect commitment to the advancement of individual, social, and global transformation.
Sharanam Prapadye Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapadye Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapadye.
That was Krishna Das. You're listening to Conscious Living Radio on Cooperative Station 100.5 FM. My name is Andrew Resmer.
And I'm Tasha Sims. Welcome to the show. So it's that time of year again. 36th annual Vancouver International Film Festival is about to begin September 28th to October 13th. And joining us tonight is filmmaker Robert Lieberman. His documentary, Angkor Awakens, A Portrait of Cambodia, will be screening at the festival Sunday, October 1st at 6:30, and then again Tuesday, October 3rd at 11:30. All that information will be online. Robert's part of the physics faculty at Cornell University. He's published 6 novels. His newest was The Boys of Truxton. His previous film, They Call It Myanmar, was a New York Times critic pick and named one of the top best dozen films of 2012 by Robert Egbert. In his current documentary, Angkor Awakens, he zeroes in on the devastating legacy of the Khmer Rouge's genocidal 4-year regime, and the film is a portrait of Cambodia's brutal past and the impact on its future generations. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thanks so much. Can I correct a couple things?
Yes. My pronunciation?
It's Roger Ebert who named it, they call it Myanmar, a top doc.
There you go. We're Canadian. What can I tell you?
I know, you're living in another country.
But a nice country, a really nice one.
Well, no, I've spent a lot of time in British Columbia. It's God's country.
It's true. So thanks for joining us tonight. I found your film was so powerful and intimate at the same time, and I wonder if we could just start with what inspired you to make the film and perhaps even touch on your background in terms of the Holocaust and how that might have influenced your making this choice.
First of all, I don't know why I do what I do when I write novels. I don't know quite what I'm up to when I make movies. I don't know. It's sort of a voyage of discovery. And I did a film, they call it Myanmar, with Aung San Suu Kyi, who happens to be very newsworthy right now. And I was in the neighborhood, and I figured, you know, after 4 years working in Burma, I thought I would go to Cambodia, and then began to discover. I knew about the Khmer Rouge period. I knew about the genocide. It was a case where Pol Pot and his people went crazy and decided to take the country back to year zero. As you mentioned, I'm a child of the Holocaust. My parents, I'm German speaking as a first language. My parents escaped Vienna with my older brother. I was born in the States, but I've got one foot in Europe. What your parents go through does affect you, and it affects mm-hmm. you in many ways. It affects you both, you know, it's both nature and nurture. They're doing studies now on epigenetics where, in fact, people who suffer trauma, their children, that's passed on to the
mm-hmm.
children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's epigenetics, it's above the genome. But anyhow, I was curious to see what effects the Khmer Rouge genocide had on the young Cambodians today.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a film where we sweep through history of the country and really sort of probe it, you know, psychologically. And there are a lot of very, I think you'll agree, since you've seen the film, a lot of very intimate discussions.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes very upsetting, sometimes enlightening.
So can we give our listeners a sketch of the history and how it led to this horrific genocide, and maybe touch on too, the thing that really intrigues me is why it's so important right now, because I think it's timely, and I don't know if you agree, but I have a sense that you may, just in terms of remembering, and I guess I'm looking at the American involvement too and wondering about that, and you know, where we're at today politically. Can you
wow.
give us some I know
You've hit me with a lot. Look, history seems to repeat itself. Right now in Cambodia, there's real trouble brewing. We have an interview with Hun Sen, who's the sort of strongman dictator who's been in power 36 years. And he has just shut down one of the major papers, the Cambodian Daily. He's closed 15 radio stations. They can no longer get Radio Free Asia or Voice of America. Somehow by magic, I got him into our film. He never gives interviews. But I think that Hun Sen he in fact says so. He, in so many words, he's channeling Donald Trump. And this is happening all over the world. So the message that you know our president is sending is, you know, it's Duterte in the Philippines, you know, I could go on and on, but this is a case where I think we have to go back in history. Pol Pot, who came from a middle class family, went to study in Paris, and that's where he became a Marxist. And he returned to Cambodia and began this operation, gaining power to take the country back to its agrarian roots. I mean, in theory, it was a reasonable idea, bringing the country back to its agrarian roots, that to start all over and reimagine the country. The only trouble is that it resulted in, you know, a third of the population, I think it is, being killed. And I think people know about the Khmer Rouge period. They don't. They should see Angkor Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
This was sort of a cultural revolution on steroids, as one of our interviewees calls it. The cities were emptied. Phnom Penh was totally emptied. The people in the city were told that the Americans were going to bomb, and they had to leave. And, of course, it was a trick to get them out of the cities. And then they were essentially, you know, starved, beaten, murdered, children, you know, even infants were sort of picked up by their feet and slammed against the trees. It's a horrific genocide occurred. And it was only when the Vietnamese came in and, in quotes I'll say, liberated the country that the killing stopped. And interestingly enough, the prime minister today was put into power by the Vietnamese, and he's been in power ever since. And this is a country that, on the one hand, is becoming a sort of moving into the 20th century, and, you know, on the other hand, is moving further and further towards dictatorship and repression.
And it really was when it talks about, you know, even wearing glasses could have you labeled as an intellectual.
That's right. The idea was to get rid of all the educated, anybody who spoke a foreign language, any of the previous bourgeoisie. Mm-hmm. You know, they were going to wipe out the entire educated class, and they succeeded in essentially in doing that. So this is a country. You know, there's a diaspora. There are Cambodians who escaped to the United States and Canada and to France, but this is a country that has had to rebuild itself in 1975 when the Khmer Rouge was thrown out and defeated. The country has had to really rebuild itself right from the ground, which is a daunting task. So, you know, everything, the arts, you know, education, everything had to be reconstituted. And I think the country's still in the process of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing to me is that it's Cambodians wiping out Cambodians.
Yes, Cambodians killing Cambodians. And you talked about the U.S. involvement, and I think we need to speak about that. One of the people who appears in the film is John Gunther Dean, the last U.S. ambassador from the United States to Cambodia. And he talks about how he knew when he left that he was turning, essentially, the Cambodians over to the butchers.
Uh-huh.
He talks about his own background, how growing up Jewish in Germany, he had seen the same thing happening, essentially. There's an interesting story. Do we have time for a long story?
We do.
I'm working on this film, and Dennis Gray, who's a correspondent in Thailand, has a story on the Wire, AP Wire, about Cambodia's, the United States' last ambassador in Cambodia, named John Gunther Dean. So I contacted him, Dennis Gray, and he sends me John Gunther Dean's contact information. And so I send John Gunther Dean an email, and the next day he calls me from Paris. And we start to talk, and I told him I'm working on a film. We're just, almost completing a film about, Cambodia. And I'm listening to him, and then I hear, of course, this accent. I said, "Du kannst Deutsch, nicht wahr?" You speak German. "Ah, selbstverständlich," he says, and we switch to German. And I asked him, when did his parents come over? And he says, 1939, about the time my parents came. And where did you come to? And he says, Kew Gardens, Queens, where I grew up. And I said to him, what school did you go to? And he says, PS99, my school where I was always in trouble.
Wow.
And what did your father do? He says, he was a lawyer. My father was a lawyer, too. And by the way, he says, I have a maiden grandmother whose last name is Lieberman.
Oh,
he says,
wow.
You have to come to Paris. I said, I'm working on a film there, an animated film with the French, and I just had left Paris. He said, no, you have to come. So essentially, I turned the plane around for him. He said, I'll have a car waiting for you. And so I went essentially back to Paris. I spent 3 days interviewing him. He's a lovely man, and his wife, Martine. And as I'm walking out the door, I stop after 3 days. I said, John, do you happen to know Hun Sen? And he says, yes, he's a friend. Oh? And I said, would you provide me with an invitation? And in fact, he sat down. He's 90 years old. He sat down at his desk. He wrote an invitation. Needless to say, as soon as I got back to the United States, the first thing I did was contact the Cambodian embassy in Washington. You know, things go back and forth, and I'm ready to fly to Phnom Penh if the possibility opens up. Hun Sen has not given an interview, I don't think, since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
With the BBC. He does not give interviews. And it turns out I'm ready to fly to Phnom Penh, and it turns out he's coming for the first time to the United Nations for the big General Assembly. And so I get a chance to actually interview him. And he's staying in, I think it's the Pierre, right on, right off Grand Central, off Central Park. And I managed the night before to get into his suite. We had a lot of equipment. Parking is a nightmare, as you may not understand, in New York. I jump out. I talk my way past the bellhop. I get into his suite. I plant everything in there. Next morning, we arrive with the crew. And there is, there's Secret Service. There are his people. There's the New York City Police. And we're ready for the interview. And his Secretary of State comes out. He's the translator. And I said to the guys, all the security people, I said, this is kind of interesting. No one has checked my bags. I brought these bags in last night. Oh, says the Secretary of State, opening a dossier. Oh, we know who you are. And by the way, I submitted some questions early, and here are all the answers. And I said, do you think maybe the Prime Minister would let me throw these away and we could just have a free-ranging mm-hmm. discussion? And he said, well, talk to the Prime Minister. Well, Hun Sen comes in. He's led in by these women. these buxom women in army uniforms, and the guys he's with are cool. You can crack jokes with the Cambodians. They're always friendly and smiling. But these women have just tight-lipped. Anyhow, so we stand up for the prime minister, and then I said to him, do you think, you know, we could just, you know, I'm interested in you as a human being, not just as a politician. Do you think we could just have a casual discussion? And he says, sure, go ahead. And for two solid hours, I'm eyeball to eyeball with Hun Sen. Now, the interesting thing is, he is a former Khmer Rouge commander. And he, in fact, defected to the Vietnamese side. And then when the Vietnamese came in, he came in, and they made him, I think, secretary, foreign secretary first, and then he becomes prime minister. And so I have this amazing, we use a few minutes of the interview, because this is not the Hun Sen movie, but I have a two-hour rare interview, and it's really, you know, it's a historical document. So mm-hmm. I don't know what we're going to do with it, but it's online, actually, a little piece of it. If people go to Encore Awakens, and on YouTube, they go Hun Sen, H-U-N-S-E-N, Encore, and it's not E-N-C-O-R-E, you know, it's A-N-G-K-O-R, Encore Awakens. They can see that clip. And they can also go to our website. There's tons of information on there about Cambodia.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
And Cambodia really, you know, the movie isn't about Cambodia. It's something I discovered only lately. It's really about the human condition. It's about tribalism. It's about the U.S. involvement. You know, we were bombing, the Americans were bombing not just the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but they were bombing all the way across the country. I think 500,000 people, Cambodians, were killed. You know, this really set the stage for the Khmer Rouge. The people were terrified, and then when the Khmer Rouge came into Phnom Penh, everybody was so happy because they thought at last they were going to have peace, and of course this is only the beginning of the end. Moral of the story is, I think, you don't go into foreign countries unless you can speak the language and understand the culture. I hate to say this, but the United States has repeatedly done this.
Yeah, they haven't gotten that memo.
They haven't. There's no institutional memory. That's really the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was a war protester in the 60s, but it took a long time to bring that war to an end, and we could go talk about that for hours.
There's a piece in the interview you did with him that, you know, just took me aback when he was talking about Obama. Is Obama, he was talking about whether his police, when they, you know, were being violent, whether he's him being responsible for that, he paralleled
to
Obama.
I have footage of, you know, there were protests, unprecedented protests a couple of years ago. I have footage of that. And then suddenly the police start wading in, and then the shootings began. And, yeah, Hun Sen says, you know, why are you blaming me? He said, here we are in New York City, and there are people being killed by the New York City police. Do you blame Obama for that?
Right.
That's the reason. He also said to me that if I were to be invited to his house for dinner, and he was responsible for killing a chicken, I would probably starve, because he has never killed anybody, much less a chicken. He could not even kill a chicken. I missed my chance, and I should have asked him if he ate chicken.
Yeah, you did.
So this is a film, you know, that's large in scope. You know, when you make a documentary, generally you want to follow a character. Well, the character's the country, basically. Mm-hmm. The people in the country. And we did the same thing in They Call It Myanmar. Same thing. Oh, I couldn't film there. Actually, you're not supposed to film in Cambodia without permission, and I'm not one to ask for permission. And in Burma, Myanmar, I was secretly filmed for, you know, until things finally opened up and Suu Kyi was released from prison.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing to me that's fascinating is that people are not talking about it. When, you know, your documentary touches on that, that a lot of the people who went through the genocide are tight-lipped and not necessarily passing it on to their, as part of their history. Tell us what you think about that and the repercussions.
I think it's so painful that they don't want to talk about it, because I think in the Holocaust you have the same thing. People mm-hmm. who went to concentration camps, they're not talking about it. They had to do things that survive, you know, and in Cambodia, you know, in the concentration camps, and the Cambodians had to lie, steal, cheat, do anything they could to find some food. I mean, they were eating insects and frogs if they were so lucky. So I think you don't, you know, sometimes you had to live at the expense of someone else dying. And I'm sure it's too painful to talk about it. And on the other hand, the children don't really know what happened. They have a vague idea. And the parents will say, you know, eat your food. You know, if this was the Khmer Rouge period, you'd starve. You know, you can't waste food. And the old people have really a fear of the Khmer Rouge coming back. That's something that permeates the culture. Also, I think that fuses are short, and that a small thing can happen, like, you know, a fender bender, a little accident, and it can very quickly turn violent just because there's this underlying current of tension mm-hmm. always under the surface.
Do you think that fear plays out in terms of education, the fact that highly educated people were so targeted? Does that play out in the parents' perspective on their own kids becoming too educated?
I don't think that. I just think the educational system was wrecked, and I think it's still not great. I mean, that's, you know, what's the most important resource of any country? It isn't minerals, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially the young people. And so that resource is not being fully developed. There are thousands of NGOs working literally a couple of thousand NGOs working in Cambodia. But I fear there's some very good ones, but there are many that are self-serving. And I worry that they're doing what the government should be doing. So the government is a kleptocracy, basically. And so the money is not going to the people. A lot of tourists go to Siem Reap, to see Angkor Wat, this huge complex of temples. I mean, there are millions of people every year, and none of that money, you know, reaches the Cambodian people. So, yeah, you know, they're, you know, essentially Hun Sen is feathering his nest and his family's nest and his cronies' nest. But you know what? I hate to say this, but the same thing is going on in the United States, where the Trumps are feathering their nest, you know, shamelessly doing so. And Hun Sen is shamelessly doing so. This film is really much more than Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
At least I think it is. It's maybe a look at the human condition, a look at tribalism. You know, we always need an other, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, and you mentioned that as well with when the Khmer Rouge was feeling like they were failing, not achieving their goals, that they needed an enemy to explain those failures.
That's right, and the enemy also was within, and it was the Vietnamese, and they were trying to gain back territory lost, you know, hundreds of years earlier, you know, in Cambodia Krom, in Kampuchea Krom, which is southern Vietnam, and they start attacking the Vietnamese, and they had this reasoning that if every one of our soldiers killed 10 Vietnamese, we could win. And, of course, that didn't work, but it provoked the Vietnamese, who then ultimately came in and routed the Khmer Rouge.
So say a bit more about the American situation and just this whole idea, because that's what I keep seeing is it's us against them. There's like Trump keeps sort of feeding this this good guy, bad guy thing. I mean, it's, you know, and it's not only is it all wrong, but it's just feeding separation, right?
Well, you know what's interesting, since I'm getting on in years, and I lived through the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and I see what's happening now very much like what happened in the 60s. It was, you know, America, love it or leave it. If you were against the war, you were un-American. There was a separation. I couldn't even talk to my rural mailman. I was afraid, you know. I lived in Hong Kong for a while during the Vietnam War, and I broke a party up just by talking to some pilots. And, you know, they were saying, oh, man, you know, when you dropped the napalm, you wouldn't believe the flak that was coming up to greet the plane. You know, it was really bad. And I was saying, hey, if somebody was bombing your home, wouldn't you start shooting at them? And they, you know, suddenly this whole party turned into a riot. I really destroyed someone's party. There was this real schism in the United States, and it was abroad too, of course. But, you know, about, yeah, and it took a long time for Americans to understand, and I think we're all in agreement now that the Vietnam War was a disaster, was a mistake. You know, if you want, we can talk about Iraq, we can talk about Libya, we can go on and on. George W. Bush and his friends destabilizing the Middle East. But that's not about the film.
Yeah. I mean, we've got about 5 more minutes, and I do want to keep it global, because I think it, definitely the film does feel like it's, has the potential to awaken people to thinking globally. And I just wonder if there's a message for you that you're hoping to touch the world with, and if so, what that would be exactly.
I don't know. See, I don't make message documentaries. I really, and my novels too, they're not messages.
Okay, let me ask you a different way then.
Yeah.
Your heart. What, if your heart could speak, what would it say to the world? What do you yearn? What do you wish the world understood?
I suppose that the world, people need compassion and need consideration and respect for other people. It's simple respect and consideration. And I suppose empathy. You've got to put yourself in the shoes of other people. You've got to think as they think. And, you know, one thing, I've been all over the world. I've been in every country except, I think, Australia and Antarctica. And what's very interesting is if you're in Africa or you're in Asia or you're in North America or Europe, it's all the same. People might have a little different skin color or eye shape, but they all love their children. And they laugh and they cry and care about, you know, themselves and their families. Nobody is different. People are the same. That's incredible. All over the planet. This is a huge planet. And we're really, and so always having the other, you know. Well, I think that's sort of almost built into people's psyche. I think we're hardwired for that, and I think we have to fight that. And that's what the movie might be is about, if you know. I think all my work, my novels, I've done a comedy, I've directed, lots of novels, films, all of them have sort of a moral core to them, maybe this Jewish sense of justice. By the way, The Last Boy, which has come out recently, is really about global warming, but it doesn't seem that it's that, because it's the story of a child who disappears from daycare, and the mother's search for the child, and it doesn't seem like that's what the story is about. It looks like a detective story, a mystery, but it has this underpinning. I did a book many years ago called Paradise Rezoned, which is, I think the title tells you what it's about. So I think all my stories, I hate to say, have a message, because they become preachy, and you don't, you know, I'm an entertainer. That's really what I am. I'm a storyteller. That's what I am. And if, incidentally, you know, there's a message, great, but you can just bore the pants off people with messages. I don't want to make boring movies. I want to make movies that take you for a ride.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that this film grabs you by the collar and doesn't let go, because I've been sitting, you know, we traveled all over the United States with the film. You know, it was in New York, it was in Washington, it was held over everywhere, L.A., Seattle, San Francisco, Berkeley. Anyhow, what's interesting is that I sit in the back and I watch and listen. There's not a peep. Nobody's picking up their cell phone and texting. So that's the test, you know. Are people, yeah, do I have your attention? Have I taken you for the trip? And I think Encore Awakened takes people, I hope. We'll see. I mean, are Canadians different from Americans?
No. I think the road we're going down is we really all are the same beyond the stories, beyond, you know, we are. And I think it's... We are the same. It's a fantastic film. I really hope our audience gets out there because I know we've got two screenings, Sunday, October 1st at 6:30 at Cinematheque, and then Tuesday, October 3rd, 11:30 at International Village 10.
And I'll be there.
And you'll be there for both of those?
Yeah.
Or
Yeah, for both.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, no, the Vancouver's Film Festival is flying me up. I'm now in San Francisco headed towards you.
Yay.
Headed to God's country.
Well, tell our listeners where they can find out more just about you. Do you have a website or anything?
Yeah, I have a website. It's called RobertHLieberman.com. And also, there's a listing of books and films. And also, all these films are available on digital platforms right now. And, you know, I'll be at the theater, and I'd love to meet people and talk to them and answer their questions. Not that I'll necessarily have the answers, and I'm not sure if I answered your questions.
Oh, I think it was great. And our listeners can find out more also on consciouslivingradio.org, more about the Vancouver Film Festival and screenings, and I hope they come out and see this film. And I think it's wonderful, Robert, and I appreciate you joining us tonight.
Yeah. Hello, Canada.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you maybe at the screening.
Definitely.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Co-op Radio.
Todo lo que tenemos es lo que necesitamos, y el amor de Dios para siempre ya estará, para hacer su trabajo y vivir con la paz, que la promesa del cielo esté contigo, que la promesa del cielo esté contigo. Cuando todo lo que tenemos es lo que necesitamos, y el amor de Dios para siempre ya estará, para hacer su trabajo y vivir con la paz, que la promesa del cielo esté contigo, que la promesa del cielo esté contigo, que la promesa del cielo esté contigo, que la promesa del cielo esté contigo. Cuando todo lo que tenemos es lo que necesitamos, y el amor de Dios.